Economics is the study of human choice in the world we live. Faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. By investigating faith in economics, we can learn how they lead to human flourishing. This is the Faith in Economics Podcast, a presentation of the Gortney Institute at Ottawa University.
Welcome to our show today. I'm Cole McCray, producer and undergraduate scholar for the Gortney Institute. With us, we have Dr. Russ McCullough, the founder of the Gortney Institute, and Wayne Angel Chair of Economics, Dr. Justin Clark, the Menard Family Professor of Philosophy and Ethics, and Dr. Peter Jacobson, the Gortney Professor of Economic Education and Research.
All right, so we're back, and we're going to talk about books. And before you hit fast forward or stop the recording, we're going to do something special with it. Peter had an idea, so hear us out here on the plan for the podcast today related to some books. Peter, take it away.
Yeah, so our readers are all intelligent people, and they look for things other than just watching Netflix shows, and so they want to find good things to read. And so our goal is we're going to just talk through some books that we like. And the ground rules of this are that we're going to try to avoid books from our profession. And so, like, I could recommend you 30 economics books. But you hear me talk about those all the time in the podcast anyway. They just kind of naturally come up. I'll bring up Mises or Simon or whatever. So we don't want to make this like a go-to-school thing. And so Justin's not going to talk about philosophers. Russ and I are not going to talk about free markets and economics. We're going to talk about other books that we like. We're also going to avoid the Bible because it's an obvious one, right? Like, I obviously recommend that you read the Bible. This is the Faith in Economics podcast, so it wouldn't be a surprise. I don't need to explain why, because, you know, listen to all the other podcasts, right? That's why. So we're going to focus on both fiction and nonfiction, whichever one people are interested in. It could be, you know, history, it could be like fantasy, sci-fi, doesn't really matter to me. The idea is I want all of us to give some books and then explain why you think people should read them, why you like them and all that. So does someone want to start off, or should I start us off?
Why don't you start us off?
Okay, I'll start us off.
I second that.
So my first recommendation, and we might have, depending on our time, we might get through a few, we might just get through one, is called On the Marble Cliffs. And it's by Ernst Jünger. On the Marble Cliffs is a good story. It was written during the rise of the Nazi regime, and Ernst Jünger was a German, and he lived through the rise of the Nazi regime. It's widely considered to be an anti-Nazi book that was published at the time. And the story is the only reason he wasn't killed for it is because Hitler liked Jünger's World War I memoir enough that he didn't want to kill him over it. Jünger, by the way, to the end of his life, denied that it was a direct allegory. He said something like, it's a shoe that fit many feet or something like that. And so the idea being that, well, it was probably true of Germany then. It was probably true of Russia with the rise of the communists. But I think it's a great book. It's both very slow paced and then later very fast paced. And I think that especially if you are more politically populist, which I tend to be, I lean that way, I think it's a good mirror for you. Because I think it shows the true danger of populism. I think we hear a lot of fake danger of populism on the news or whatever. But I think Jünger does a good job of highlighting what like actually dangerous populism can look like. And so it was a book that challenged me is my main thought.
I think I'm going to pick one of a book that I just finished called Deep by James Nestor. And it's a book about competitive freediving. And I don't know if you guys know what competitive free diving is.
No, I have no idea.
No.
Okay. It's in the ocean. It's swimming down, as the title of the book says, deep.
So like as far as you can go sort of situation?
As far as you can go sort of situation.
Killing yourself?
Equipment or no?
No equipment.
Okay. That's no scuba tank, dive. No nothing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I guess just to kind of pick your brains on this, like what do you think people... You guys have been in swimming pools before.
Yeah.
What do you think people swim down to?
Gosh.
So I have heard of people going ridiculous distances, but if I don't let that color my opinion, I would guess like humanly, I would think like 36 feet would be
40,
something that would be like,
most,
yeah. Because like I'm already like, by the time I go down to the bottom of the swimming pool, I'm already starting to feel my lungs, and you know, swimming pools are 10 to 12, right?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking like three or four swimming pools. I can't imagine doing more than that. So,
Yeah, so the records are like around between 300 and a little over 300 feet.
And no flippers either, right?
Sometimes it depends on, there are different
Okay.
categories in it.
Oh,
You can,
okay.
there's
Yeah.
one which allows like a
Vinyl.
monofin.
Okay.
Sure. But really, I know it sounds difficult, but at least the way it's described is after around 40 feet, since the pressure is so high, you actually aren't buoyant anymore because it compresses.
Sure.
Oh, so you
So
can fall
after 40
fast.
feet, you can just sink.
Yeah, but
Ah,
that
I did
doesn't,
not know
that's
that.
not comforting to me if I'm
Yeah.
at a
My
not
head is
buoyant
kind of
anymore.
hurting just thinking about the pressure.
One of
Yeah.
my favorite
Right.
things about swimming downwards is that I'm buoyant, actually.
Yeah.
And I will float back
Yeah,
up.
that, so you have to work to get up then, right? That would
Yeah, I
be
mean, you're
something
essentially
like.
kind of weightless, so it's just like the way the competitive free diving works is they put a disc or a plate on a rope and they
Okay.
lower it, and you have
Okay.
to go down, pick a thing, a little ticket off the plate, and take it back up.
Ah,
Now,
okay.
scuba divers don't go down that deep,
Yeah.
and the reason scuba divers don't go down that deep is because you have to go up really slowly when you
Right.
scuba dive. You actually don't have to do that when you're just doing it with your own
Is that
lungs.
right? Because you're
Yeah.
not breathing while you're moving, and the issue is like the while you're in the process of breathing, changing pressure very quickly is what causes the problem. But since
You
you're not
have
breathing at
to.
all, there's that issue doesn't
Ah.
arise. You don't get the bends or whatever.
Yeah,
I
and
hadn't thought about that.
apparently it's like addictive. People who
Oh, you kind of get some
enjoy
sort of rush like runners get or something, and
it,
then.
compress it. If your lungs are the
Yeah.
size of like three basketballs, by the time you get down there, your whole body is packed. It packs your organs up into your rib cage. Your lungs, if the amount of air in there is going to be the size of like two of your fists cupped together, and it your body instinctively sucks a bunch of blood from your extremities into your lungs
Oh,
to fill
sure.
your lung
As a
capillaries
protective
with
measure,
enough
right?
mass so that it doesn't collapse. And there's something they call it like the master switch. They always come up with like names for things, right? Where this kind of happens.
All those people come up with a name.
Yeah. And
Dude, let's call it the master switch. It just turns on.
yeah, so you can actually like a bunch, like it's getting more popular for like marine biologists to kind of get involved with this because I don't know if you've ever seen footage of somebody scuba diving, but you look like an intruding robot,
Yeah,
right? So
absolutely, yeah.
if you're free diving, you can actually get much closer to animals without disturbing them. People like swim with free diving sounded cool, made me want to do it. The book did. I'll talk about the other book this guy wrote that also made me want to do that. I joked with a friend, like, hope he doesn't write a book about something that I really don't want to do that he convinces me to do. But yeah, he talks about swimming with sharks, and that didn't sound very cool at all. But
Yeah.
the free diving part did sound cool. And so it's like this whole world that I didn't know existed. And there's a whole kind of community and subculture to it. And it's kind of adjacent to subcultures that I grew up like surfing.
Sure.
And also it's kind of adjacent to doing like Wim Hof style breath exercises
Yeah,
and
the
going
cold
in
plunge
cold plunge
stuff.
stuff, which
Yeah.
I also do and is also crazy.
Yeah, I did
That
that
can
in
be talked into
Antarctica.
doing crazy stuff. But this, like it really it was really interesting to me to read about the kind of physiological changes that these people say happens to the human body when you do this.
Yeah,
And you
that's
have
all
to
moving
learn how to
parts.
do it, and you have to learn how to, every couple feet, you have to equalize your ears. But apparently, at the bottom of a swimming pool, if you just keep going and keep equalizing your ears, it is not painful
Any
at all.
longer. Okay. Or okay.
Yeah, and apparently some kind of calm descends on you, which sounded alarmingly like the
Sounds like
kind of
death.
calm that people describe
I don't want it
who
to be
die, right?
uncalm.
Yeah.
Your body's convincing you that you don't have to worry
Close
about coming
to
back up.
near death experiences, right? So yeah, the book is called Deep. It's by James Nestor. And he also wrote a book called Breathe, which is on the kind of spawned from the Deep book. And he goes through like a bunch of breathing retreats, and you can actually like breathe yourself into a psychedelic state or
Are
whatever.
these
But
okay?
yeah.
I got to go back to the, are these free divers, is this just one of those things where they're no safety equipment, not even a rope tied to their ankle or something? Like if they run into trouble when they're down there, that they get yanked back up? Or
yeah, just there are people on the surface waiting for you. But once you get down past a certain depth,
you're just going to sink.
Not only do you sink, but there's no light.
Yeah.
You don't know which way's up.
You don't know which way's up because you can't float anymore. You're not buoyant.
Yeah.
Right. And so they have had cases where people pass out at the bottom and then, you know, the divers after 3 minutes have to go, he's not up. Let's go get him. Because the 3 minute mark is usually when they realize somebody's in trouble. Because most of these people get comfortable hold their breath for 3 minutes.
Yeah.
And
just crazy,
you know, there has been at least one death in professional competition.
Yeah.
There have been more deaths. Not in competition. It's and you know, it's one of those things where everybody goes like, do not practice this alone. Right.
Yeah.
But there's nothing tied to you to pull you back up.
Yeah. It seems like kind of off the book street, you know, street thing that you, so street quote unquote, even though you're in the water. Or it also reminds me of the free climbing.
Yeah.
Where you're not using any equipment whatsoever. There's been a few documentaries on that, which is insane too.
Yeah.
So and eventually the person who doesn't die wins. And so the people laying at the bottom of the cliff.
What blew my mind about it was that the human body can adapt.
Yeah, yeah. No, that part is very interesting. Because, yeah, I think,
and that it triggers a kind of a physiological response in the human body.
I think most people would think, like I was thinking, that it's just linear, right? You keep going down deeper and it keeps getting harder and harder with the pressure. But
to
learn that it kind of goes away or whatever, that blows me away.
And I realized, while we were talking, I realized if that's less of an issue, it's still its own issue. And like having to learn how to adjust and all that, like causes its own problems. But I chose too low of a number when I was saying like 36 to 50, because I realized like I could swim a lap underwater. I could do 50 yards, which is 150 feet. And so actually it's not that crazy.
As far as
being
I just thought the pressure would.
Yeah. Going down is obviously different than going sideways, and I'm going sideways underwater when I'm doing that, but still.
And the bends,
I mean,
but you kind of address both of them.
Yeah.
That the bends doesn't exist essentially when you're doing it this way.
Yeah. And I mean, you can't like swim up as fast as possible.
Yeah.
I think the rule is it's either like you take half as much time coming up as you do go down or the other way around. But,
and obviously these people would have some watches on that's measuring how much time they've been down. So they kind of know it takes me X amount of seconds to reasonably safely resurface.
Like
or to
any
be passing
kind of
out.
Competition, you don't say like, I've been down 10 feet, I'm going to try for 300 today.
I just meant even in the heavy competition, I assume they get to use equipment so that they know how far they are. How much time they've been under, they kind of know that my max is 3 minutes or whatever.
Most
breath.
People actually, like the competitive ones, close their eyes the whole time.
Really?
Yeah.
So they just do it by feel then more.
Yeah, because the pressure is going to push goggles against, you know, like into your eye sockets at that point. That's why like scuba diving, you always have the mask, not goggles, because you can't do goggles when you scuba dive.
Yeah.
So,
never thought
of
that either.
It's a really...
I imagine you can open your eyes too. I mean,
pretty
it's nude salty
sport.
Water, but
yeah.
Okay. Yeah, crazy. All right. Well, this looks like a good spot for a break. I'll leave it with a cliffhanger of my what's called near sci-fi are the books I like to look at, and brings in, I think, innovation and technology. And so we'll pick it up from there after the break.
Ottawa University has an exciting new major, PPE, which stands for Philosophy, Politics, and Economics. Each of these fields is interesting in their own right, but they intersect in ways that are important to understand, both individually and for your community. If you find philosophy fascinating but want to make sure that your study of the subject is practical, if you enjoy economic analysis but want to see how economic laws interact with moral principles, if you are interested in politics but want to explore how economic and ethical realities constrain our political choices, you should consider the PPE program at Ottawa University.
This spring, Ottawa University is organizing a PPE League competition for politics, philosophy, and economics. Students in this competition will compete leveraging the ideas of philosophy, politics, and economics in various events. If you're a professor or an advisor of college students and you're interested in your school competing in PPE League this spring, contact Peter, Justin, or Russ today.
By 2030, the Gwartney Institute will be known for its alumni, supporters, and participants who incorporate economic understanding with their faith in their careers, vocations, communities, and personal lives. We have some great programming going on for high school students. We have an online microeconomics class. Yes, you can earn college credit for $200 by taking an online class. It's affordable, flexible, layered with support. Our new online micro is optimized for you. If you'd like to consider some events for your high school students or that class, please contact Justin, Peter, or Russ today. All right, we're back. We had a little pizza break actually today, and we're still finishing some of that up as we go, but we decided to jump back in. So it's on me, and I have an author that I've really enjoyed named Douglas Richards, and he specializes pretty much exclusively, I guess, in what's called near sci-fi. And so the idea of near sci-fi is that we're not writing something about like Star Wars where 300 years into the future or whatever. He kind of specializes on stuff that seems plausible that it could happen in the next 10 years, 20 years. And in some cases, it's stuff that already exists. And maybe he expands on it, on its capabilities. So some of these things would be things like drones and murder bots, which are little mini drones that if there's like a, imagine there's 100 drones swarming around this could be a marine or something, and or it could be operated from a the drones could be deployed where you're in your office like kids playing a video game, and you've got 100 of these little mini drones that are about the size of bullets, and then they can attack, and they're basically just on their own can go, instead of shooting a gun, the drones are just firing right at somebody. The drone itself is the weapon. Then there's other ones where there's drones, of course, that what we do have today where they're actually firing. But in this case, the drones are the size of like, you know, a bee or a fly. So real micro looking things. So that's kind of cool. There's exoskeletons that give people kind of superhuman strength where there's the skin or the whatever they're wearing helps their reflexes move faster. So with the exoskeleton, so imagine it can help you run faster because your muscles are moving. It's helping you contract and do your muscle movements. And it can help you run at full speed longer distances.
So this is kind of like it's not usually what I associate with you, Russ. Like I think of Russ as like econ, real estate, fishing guy. This is like a field from your normal stuff. And so how did you get into this? I'm curious.
I did like that fantasy aspect. I've never been a big Lord of the Rings and other things that way, but I think I do like pushing the envelope of reality of as we currently know it. And so I kind of stumbled into it originally. I don't think I was looking for near sci-fi, but then once I read this guy, I'm like, wow, this is really good. And so I think he's got at least 14 books out, and I've read through all of them. And he wrote, some of them were kind of for kids, but I found those equally great to read.
Yeah.
He had like 3 or 4 when he started out. And the other thing I like is I've actually reached out to him some of his stuff and sent him some emails on my opinion on something, or I had a question, and he responded right back. So he's an author that's accessible too with some of that. And then at the end of all of his books, he cites where he got the exoskeleton information. Hmm. And it's like usually from Science Today or, you know, whatever, some popular magazine. Popular Mechanics is something my dad used to read that kind of would talk about future stuff. He will cite documents from the U.S. government on maybe information. This is all public information, of course, but like that the Chinese government is already ahead of the United States with this type of, you know, weapon or potential weapon. And so stuff like that. A couple other things that he had was the fake blood cells. So you inject into your body blood cells that hold the oxygen better. And so again, you can run longer, be more fit, hold your breath longer. So the free diving competition would be over with these sorts of innovations. They could go super deep probably. And then the computer implants with, you know, having data off your eyeball. So imagine, you know, you do a Google search and you look, you just kind of stare a little bit off to the right, and there's your full screen. And as we know, some of this stuff isn't too far out with the different types of technology. And so all that stuff he kind of writes in there, and he'll say at the end of his book, he'll say, oh yeah, this particular thing, I completely made it up. It was kind of taken loosely from this, but there's really nothing really evolving on this particular thing. But, you know, A, B, C, and D, yep, these are all things that are in process, and here's the information about it. So I've really enjoyed that. I think for me, from an econ perspective, I love thinking about innovation and technology and the impacts that it has on
breaking
society.
Our rules.
Well, maybe a little bit of that. But I was trying to bring this back to like Julian Simon or something, that you know, when we have these innovations, we can just make the world so much better place, unless they're all drones that kill us. But hasn't been the direction.
Can you say the author's name and the title of a book that somebody should start with if they wanted to?
Yeah, so you could start with, so Douglas Richards is the author again. Time Frame, Amped, Game Changer. A couple of them are in a series, but otherwise they're pretty much standalone books. So those are three that are great. I liked them all. So, and he does end up with some of his books using some of the toys, so to speak, the exoskeleton or some of those concepts make their way into different multiple books. So that's out there. But yeah, fun stuff. And like I said, the tie back, the innovation and technology, since it's already there, it's like, it makes you think like, okay, here's what war looks like. Maybe some conflicts with China, Middle East, and, you know, pick your thing, and like, wow, how much different would that look if our soldiers had this ability, right? And it kind of can shock you a little bit to think, if we're kind of close to that, the world could look a little different if that was actually developed by an enemy of ours before we had it. It could be kind of scary. So that's the scare factor of it.
So I'll go ahead and go next, unless Cole wants to hop in.
Right, I better keep thinking, so.
Okay, that's fine.
Why don't you go ahead, yeah.
So I had a fiction one last time. This one is gonna be a memoir. I think Justin has read it at least. So unfortunately, I try to make my recommendations both for the people in the room, but also the general audience. But this is gonna be one that Justin knows that I've read, and I think has read himself, which is, I'm gonna qualify with, this is not a book for children. You should be an adult, and so you should recognize that, like, this is written by a comedian, and it's a modern comedian. This is my way of saying it's a raunchy book. Not terrible, but it's not a PG book. It's a PG-13 book. And that's Norm MacDonald's memoir, which is titled Norm MacDonald, based on a true story or something like that.
He said it was a modern comedian. I don't know if I should tell you this on the air, but he died.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't even know he was sick.
A dead comedian, actually, to clarify.
Yeah, by modern, I mean like 21st century comedian, right? And the reason I love the book is pretty straightforward. The whole book, Norm, plays with the format of the book. It's a very different memoir. He almost, I read it as he's making fun of, to a large degree, celebrity memoirs with this book. And so it's described as a memoir, but a lot of it is clearly fictional, but actually some of it, it's very hard to tell if it's fictional or not in a way that's very interesting. Norm talks about, for example, having some like pretty deep childhood trauma, and the way that he discusses it, you can't tell if he's being honest or not. You can't tell if it's part of this like fictional side of the book or part of the real side of the book. And I think that was like, it's written in a powerful way. He also plays with this idea of there being a ghostwriter. He plays with that idea, though, from what I, like, the secondary, you know, tertiary rumors that I've heard about this are that he jokes about there being a ghostwriter, but there isn't. Like, he invented the ghostwriter and wrote the book himself. So I think Norm is one of the smartest comedians of our day, if not like ever. So I'd recommend it to anybody. And it's obviously by Norm MacDonald.
Hilariously, I think the New York Times criticized him in their review because it's titled, what's the title of it?
Do you remember? It's Norm MacDonald, based on a true story.
Based on a true story. A memoir.
Right? Yeah.
And then it has like he gets called up to meet God in it and stuff. And the New York Times, their review, were like, we don't know if this is all actually true. Like, it's all based. That was their review of it. Like,
yeah, at one point, the mafia is trying to murder him. Yeah. Like, it's clearly there are made up things in it. But that's like part of the fun, right? It's actually like a very clever way to frame a fiction story as pretending like it's a memoir. Like, yeah. There's something like genius to that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'll second Peter's recommendation. I love that book.
Yeah, I think I need to try that.
I think my second one is a book called What is Real by Adam Becker, and it's about the revolution in quantum mechanics in the 20th century. And there are a couple good primers you can get on what exactly quantum mechanics is. If you just want like the nuts and bolts version of it, I think David Albert's Quantum Mechanics and Experience is a great one if you just want to know the quantum mechanics part and what's spooky about it. But Adam Becker's does a really great job of not only explaining what the quantum revolution was from Einstein forward, but explaining the development of like the measurement problem in quantum mechanics as a story about personalities in science. So you get the feud between Einstein and Bohr. You get Bohr, who was famous for the quantum interpretation of mechanics, the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, which is usually described as, I think, by Feynman as, you know, the shut up and calculate school, which is like, there's no, stop asking questions about where the particles go, just do the math and tell me what the device is going to say when we're done with it.
So before we go too much further into this, I know this is a big task and it's also the topic of the book. Can you briefly say, like in a sentence or two, vaguely what quantum mechanics is relating to?
Yeah, so quantum mechanics, as it developed in the 20th century, dealt with the fact that when we look at really, really small pieces of the world under our best looking at small pieces of the world technology, it doesn't seem like those bits of the world operate by the rules that we expect everything else to operate by. It seems like, and this is when we're talking about pieces like photons, right? So in the classic like double slit experiment, we shoot photons through a foil that has two slits in it. And it looks like light behaves like a wave as long as we are looking at where the photons hit. But if on the other hand, we put a little counter at the foil that has the slit in it, then all of a sudden the pattern that's shown on the piece of paper or whatever the receptor after that changes. And so it begins to look like nature or photons, nature, whatever. It seems to be doing different things based on whether we're looking at it and on which part of it that we are looking at. And then there are other experiments that seem to show that it seems like a particle can be, we can't say that a particle takes path A or path B. And we can't say that the particle takes both path A and path B. And we can't say that the particle takes neither path A or path B.
But somehow it gets to from beginning to end.
But those are the only two paths that it can take. And somehow it ends up where both those paths lead. And so there are at least three or four different major theories about what is going on. I think in the 20th century, Bohr's version of the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, these are all called interpretations because they attempt to tell us what's actually going on. Everybody agrees about what our measurement devices are going to say when we do these experiments. What they don't agree on is what is happening when we're not looking. So people have probably heard of like Schrodinger's cat, right? Which is, you know, that
sounds like another podcast.
The cat is neither dead or alive until we look, like it's in a superposition of being both dead and alive, right? That's Ernest Schrodinger put this thought experiment forward, and he put it forward as saying, like, this is insane. Cat can't both be alive and dead. And now this is kind of taken as dogma as no, the cat is both alive and dead, right? And that's the Copenhagen interpretation. But there are at least three other possible interpretations, which all say that we get the exact same readings, right? They just have different interpretations about what's going on and we're not looking. So the quantum mechanics part's really interesting. But I found that the Becker book was really great because it tells the story of how the Copenhagen interpretation became the dominant interpretation. And indeed, the interpretation which, even though it has the same predictions as the other interpretations, you had to assent to that one, or you would essentially and sometimes be kicked out of grad school
for asking not questions. Not get funding that, for grants and
yeah, other stuff like that. There are questions we don't want you asking, and these are the answers that you should be saying to these questions, which can obviously have multiple answers. And so it's not just a good primer on like what's going on in the quantum mechanics, but it is also a good example of the ways in which fields that we tend to think are governed merely science by experiment and objective data, how much force personalities have in those fields. Absolutely. And I think it's good to have an idea about that. And physics usually is the field people point to as like, no, 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 this, right, this rigorous is rigorous physics. And not only is it like is good in the sense where you can go like, ha ha ha, you physicists are doing that. Like, it's just kind of a gripping personality story too. I guess this one and the past one that I recommended, Nestor, I like both of them too, because even though I found the subject matter interesting, I think if you didn't find the subject matter interesting, they spin it in a way where it's a good narrative that will hook you.
So one other one that I'd kind of forgotten about, but it's such a great book, I tell people about it since I read it, came out in 2006, called Ultra Marathon Man, Confessions of an All-Night Runner. So this is when I was running and pretty competitive with doing stuff. Well, this guy was borderline insane. So the ultra marathons are usually like 50-mile or 100-mile races, and he would train throughout the night. And part of what was crazy was he was burning like 20,000 calories. So it really gets into his more or less addiction to running. He would order pizzas while he's running and fold them in half and eat them all. He ordered a cheesecake, which has like, I don't know, it was like 10,000 calories. He'd eat the whole cheesecake while he's running at like, you know, he'd have to kind of plan ahead with the timing of it, but he didn't want to disrupt his family. So he would run through the night and then he'd go to work at 8 a.m. in the morning. And I don't know when he slept. I can't remember from that part of the story, but
at work.
That was what he would do to try to stabilize his family life. There was a hilarious scene where he got into his car.
This is a true story.
This is a true story. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So this is confirmed. So Dean Karnazes was his name, and he got into his car and all of a sudden his legs all, tightened up and constricted. I don't know, it spasmed basically. And he couldn't get out of his car and his leg was trapped in it. And so he had to sit there for like an hour or two with his legs basically immobile. And just weird. There's a number of other stories like that, which is like, this is just insanity. So but it's a good read, even if you're not a runner. It was very entertaining and spoke volumes about the addiction of running can be. So
yeah, I think it's interesting that like at the extremes, we both are like, we gravitate as like outside observers, but also like it seems like people all have, or a lot of people have that propensity to do something that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense, like these people who are diving practically to their death, or people who are I don't even like running for 4 minutes. I hate running. One, you're talking about hours.
Four, and then five,
you know, that's normal hours for a marathon, but someone who's running all throughout the night, it's just like, it's interesting how, I don't know that whether we understand it or not, but how some people's brains are able to make something that seems like misery enjoyable. And then also this, the other interesting aspect is like why we as people are interested or intrigued by that rather than just wanting to like burn these people at the stake for big missions or something like that. Right. So,
right. All right, well, that looks like a good place to wrap, unless anybody's got any final words. Hopefully it's been an enjoyable podcast, a little bit lighthearted, tie in some things. I kind of forgot that I could have brought in Faith in one of Douglas Richards' books. they go back in time and Jesus is there in the altar. So that's our faith component for today. I'll just wrap up with that.
I think we could also do like a podcast on like religious related, you know, Christian books and stuff like that. Yeah. I think that'd be interesting too, because that's its own topic. That's the difficulty.
I guess I will. So one of the reasons I reached out to him is the way he depicted Jesus. I could tell that he wasn't like a follower, but he was inquisitive. And I kind of wanted to, I guess, be a little witnessing opportunity. That was my first time I reached out to him, and he was really receptive to it because he's not a believer, but I thought the way he depicted Jesus, he didn't downplay it, if that makes sense. And I thought he did it in a respectful way. And I really admired that from him not being a believer, but he did it in a very respectful way. So anyway, that was my email back to him. So that's our way. We'll wrap this one up with some little bit of faith components. So
great.
Well, this has been a production of the Gordon Institute here at Ottawa University. I'd like to thank you all for listening. 5-star rating helps other people find us. Otherwise, pass this along to your friends and family that might like to listen. So other than that, be fruitful and multiply. Thanks.